songwriter studio for this intimate interview with one of Rock and Roll's.
Everybody, this is Big Kevin. Don't forget to tune in Tuesday mornings, 3 to 5 a.m. right here on KPFT for the Roots Rock Revolution program. Because I don't even know what I'm going to play, but I guarantee we'll have a good time together. So check us out Tuesday mornings, 3 to 5 a.m., KPFT, Houston.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, well, today I'm going to read some of the emails that I get concerning science and its impact on our lives. One question I get concerns my book, where I talk about the science of the mind. And the question that I raised in that book was dreaming. Is it possible that science can one day unravel the mystery of dreams? Some people think, ha, impossible. Dreams disappear as soon as you wake up. But no. Recently, with MRI scans and EEG scans, it's possible to make scientific statements about dreams. Where they come from, what they mean, and is it possible that you can control the direction of your dream? These are called lucid dreamers, dreamers that actually can live out their dream. And we'll find out that, yes, it is true. Science has verified the fact that there are such a thing as lucid dreamings. And then we'll say a few more things about the cutting edge of science. I work professionally in something called string theory, a theory which goes way beyond the known subatomic particles that we have today, in search of what Einstein thought would be a theory of everything. Now, some people have criticized string theory because it's very difficult to test. How do you go beyond the quarks and the neutrons and protons of today to see whether or not there could be vibrating strings vibrating in 11-dimensional hyperspace? Sounds impossible. But now, at Fermilab outside Chicago, we're getting the first experimental tantalizing hints that there could be something beyond the standard model of particles. The standard model of particles has pretty much held sway for almost 50 years. And now perhaps we're seeing glimmers of, well, hopefully, string theory. So we'll say a few things about that. The latest results are good to 1 part in 10 million. Giving us a look at the world perhaps beyond what is called the standard model of subatomic particles. And then we'll say a few things about the moon. That's right, there are going to be more and more stories about the moon in the coming years. We had, of course, the crash of a lunar probe sent by the Russians after so many decades of inactivity in that area. However, the Indians successfully had a soft landing. And next year, or maybe a little bit after that, we're going to send astronauts going back to the moon, to circle around the moon. Again, going back to our nearest celestial neighbor after an almost 50-year absence. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The lead story today concerns something that all of us indulge in, and that is dreams. But science, what does science say about dreams? Some people think nothing, because dreams just disappear as soon as you wake up, and they're fanciful. You violate the laws of physics every time you go dreaming about some bizarre world in dreamland. And so what can we learn from dreams? Nothing. But then Sigmund Freud said, no, dreams are in some sense the gateway to the mind. Well, I'm a scientist, and we believe in hard data. We can speculate all you want, but the bottom line is you have to have data to back it up. And it turns out that now we have instruments, EEG and especially fMRI machines, that have proven that something called lucid dreaming exists. Now, lucid dreaming was once considered science fiction. Lucid dreaming is when you actually are conscious while you dream. This means that you can actually make conscious decisions in dreamland. Now, some people say, well, that's impossible. Dreams, by definition, are irrational. How can you control something that is irrational? Well, it turns out that you can. Scientists now realize that lucid dreaming is a valid area of scientific, testable, reproducible information. First of all, lucid dreaming goes back thousands of years. In fact, Aristotle, the great Greek philosopher, even mentioned the whole possibility of lucid dreaming. And the Buddhists, there's actually a Buddhist sect that teaches people how to become lucid dreamers. That is, how to go to sleep at night, dream, and then control the direction of the dream because you are conscious while you are dreaming. In fact, Buddhists have even published texts about how to become a lucid dreamer. And they mention certain rules. So in principle, perhaps you too could become a lucid dreamer and consciously control the direction of your dreams. Step number one, before you go to bed, train yourself, orient yourself, say to yourself, I'm going to become a lucid dreamer. Tell yourself over and over again that when I dream, I will be in control. And then when you actually are in the dreaming state, of course, you cannot move at all. The body is paralyzed when you dream. When you undergo what is called REM sleep, it means that bodily functions, the motor functions, are shut off. Otherwise, you might injure yourself. So you are paralyzed when you dream. But then when you wake up, have a notebook. Have a notebook right next to your bed and write down the dream, even if it's fragmentary, right after you wake up. Now, of course, you're not going to be able to do lucid dreaming the first time. It takes practice. But according to Buddhist monks, it's something that, in principle, anyone can attain. But now, today, of course, we have advanced instrumentation, and we can begin to look into the mind itself by looking at blood flow in the living brain. So what do we find when you dream? When you dream, for example, and the MRI scan scans the front part of your brain, that is the prefrontal cortex, that is the conscious mind, it turns out that blood flow in that area decreases, and you are basically unconscious as a consequence. But then here's the magic. The magic is that deep inside the brain, in the limbic system of the brain, different parts of the limbic system light up, including the amygdala. The amygdala governs, well, that's where emotions, even frightful emotions, reside. And that explains why we get nightmares and disturbing dreams. So the center of our brain starts to light up, including the areas where nightmares are created. And then if you look at the back of the brain, yes, the back of the brain, those areas are also lit up too. That's perhaps the most primitive part of the human brain. So what does this mean? This means that when you dream, the conscious part of your dream has a fact checker. Has a fact checker which says, yes, that's possible. No, 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 that's not possible. No, that's outrageous. The fact checker is turned off, and that's the key. Because many times you violate all the laws of physics when you dream, but you don't care. You act normal as if it's every day, that you can fly, that you can do all sorts of magic tricks. It's like common sense, you think, that everyone can violate the laws of physics. And so the fact checker is turned off, and that explains several aspects. The aspect that you are not conscious when you dream, and the fact that you can violate the laws of physics like a magician. And also it means that the amygdala lights up. And the amygdala is where emotions are processed. especially emotions that are a little bit frightening. Nightmares reside in the amygdala. So then when you wake up, a lot of that simply disappears. And that's why if you want to become a lucid dreamer, you have to write down these facts as soon as you wake up, or else it's all going to disappear. Now, what do we make of this information? With MRI scans, we can show that yes, dreaming can be reduced to science, but what about lucid dreaming? What about people that claim that they can actually move consciously inside the dreamland? Well, it turns out that science here took volunteers, some of whom, about 1% of the general population, claim that they can actually control the direction of the dream. These are lucid dreamers. And historically, of course, there was no way to test. How do you test whether or not someone can control the direction of his dream when he's unconscious and he's paralyzed? Doesn't sound like a very good prospect for experimental science, right? But this is where science comes in again. There are actually several ways in which you can interact with a dreaming person. And as I emphasized, when you dream, you are paralyzed. Your muscles freeze, because if your muscles were perfectly movable, you'd probably hurt yourself. And some people do have a problem with that, and by golly, they hurt themselves, and they hurt their loved ones as a consequence. So what do we do? There's several ingenious ways in which you can communicate with someone who is a lucid dreamer. And that is, first of all, with an MRI machine. The MRI machine shows that the prefrontal cortex is active even as they are unconscious and dreaming. That was a breakthrough, because it meant that, yes, blood flow does take place in the conscious part of the brain. You are conscious, while the other areas, the sleep areas of the brain, are turned on. They're on simultaneously. So that was the first definitive proof that lucid dreaming is, in fact, a real phenomenon and not a hoax, not a joke that somebody uses at a cocktail party, but something that we can actually tangibly record. And then how do you communicate with a lucid dreamer? The lucid dreamer is paralyzed because, as I mentioned, you would hurt yourself if you act out your dreams. And so what scientists did was they put a rubber ball in each of the person's hand. And when the person started to dream, the scientists would say, squeeze the left ball, squeeze the right ball. And when the dreamer was in full-fledged dream mode, yes, he would be flexing the rubber band, the rubber balls, and then you can communicate with them. At that point, you can actually talk to the lucid dreamer. Are you dreaming? Yes or no. Are you dreaming about flying? Yes or no. It's a rather crude way of doing it, but it is possible thereby to communicate with a lucid dreamer. Now, then the next question is, why? Why do we dream at all? Of course, there have been many fabulous tales going back to the Bible. The Bible even mentions dreaming, that one day the king was dreamt that there were live calves and then calves that got sick. And then the king wondered, why? Such a strange dream that one day the calves are fine, the next day they're sick. And then the prophets, according to the Bible, said that it means the fact that you will have good years of plenty, that for many years you will have plenty of food to feed the people, but then there'll be famine and drought. And that means that you have to stock up on foods during the good years. And lo and behold, it came to pass that that's what happened. So anyway, dreams are recorded in the Bible. Dreams are recorded in Buddhist texts. And then the question is, why? Why do we dream at all? Is this some message from heaven, which the Bible seems to indicate what it is? And of course, Sigmund Freud had a famous theory of the mind. The mind had basically three basic urges to it. And sometimes these urges are manifested in our dreams. and therefore the dreams indicate basically our mental state. Well, there are other theories about dreams. Another theory about dreams says it's like a file cabinet. Dreams throw lots of information at you. Some of the information is unpleasant, but you have to file them away. So a dream is nothing but a way in which the brain reduces the clutter, like the clutter on your desk, reduces the clutter and tries to make sense of these incidences that happen during the day, especially ones that are unpleasant. And so that's another theory, that dreams are basically housekeeping. Housekeeping to make sure that dangerous dreams are under control, that you can accommodate and relive some of these dreams so that they become harmless. Well, that's yet another theory of dreams. Well, unfortunately, science has not advanced to the point where we can definitively say that we understand dreams. However, some scientists believe that dreams could be, as Freud thought, the royal road toward the unconscious mind. Because the unconscious mind has to take all this data from the conscious mind and make sense of it. So maybe that's the purpose of dreams, to make sense of the strange world that we see around us, so that nightmares can be controlled, so that we gain insight into our thinking processes. Well, who knows? But at least now we have the instruments by which we can begin to tease apart the mystery of dreams. And now let me say a few things from my field. My field is theoretical physics. I work professionally in an area called string theory, which we think but cannot yet prove is the, quote, theory of everything, the theory that eluded Einstein for the last 30 years of his life, searching for an equation, perhaps no more than 1 inch long, that would, quote, allow him to read the mind of God, unquote. Well, the main criticism of string theory, to be honest, is that it's untestable because it exists in a realm of energy far beyond the machines that we can muster today. So the problem is not theoretical. Maybe string theory is correct. Who knows? But how do you prove it, given the fact that the true home of string theory exists at energy scales beyond what we can create in the laboratory? Well, what can we create in the laboratory? We can create certain subatomic particles. They can be arranged in a graph called the Standard Model. The Standard Model has quarks, electrons, neutrinos, subatomic particles that you hear once in a while on the evening news. And these subatomic particles work. That is, the Standard Model does, in fact, describe the subatomic world. It's a smashing success. But there's a problem. It is ugly as sin. It has 36 quarks and antiquarks, 36 of them. It has a whole slew of subatomic particles, three generations of redundant subatomic particles, in fact, a whole zoo of gluons and Yang-Mills particles. It doesn't seem to make much rhyme or reason. We thought nature would be pure, simple, elemental at the subatomic, sub-subatomic realm, but in fact, instead we find this ugly mess called the Standard Model, which works. It does fit the data. So some scientists believe that if we can find a deviation in the Standard Model, perhaps the deviation at the highest energy level would come from string theory. And that's what the excitement is about that we profiled in previous programs of exploration. We have a particle called the muon. It's like a heavy electron, about 200 times the weight of an electron. And it is one of the main constituents of cosmic rays. There are muons in your body, whizzing through your body right now. Even as we speak, your body is being riddled by muons, or heavy electrons. And these heavy electrons have a magnetic field. Now, when you measure the magnetic field, it is very sensitive to particles of tremendous energy. So in some sense, the presence of these high energy particles, which is very difficult to decipher because they are so energetic, is encoded in tiny corrections to the magnetic field of the muon. So by measuring the magnetic field of the muon, we can compare it with the theoretical value, and there seems to be a mismatch. This is exciting news. At least to a physicist, it is very exciting news. The first known deviation to the standard model. And some people are saying, aha, aha. It indicates the fact that there is a higher theory, a theory beyond the standard model, which could be string theory. Well, the recent results just announced from Fermi Laboratory outside Chicago is that this deviation is one part in 10 million. Now, that's not a big deviation, you may think, but that's big enough. That's big enough to hint the fact that there's a whole new world beyond the standard model at energies that we cannot access. So this is exciting news. As Einstein once said, if you see a tail, it could be the tail of a lion. Well, that's what string theorists hope, that perhaps we're getting the first measurable scientific indication, a glimmer of hope, that yes, there is a theory beyond the standard model of particles, which contains quarks, electrons, neutrons, protons, and that theory at a higher energy scale is string theory. Well, I'll tell you more as we get better and better data from the magnetic field of the mu meson, but this is exciting news. The first major experimental deviation from the standard model, which hints at the presence of another theory. Perhaps that theory could be string theory. Well, next we're going to go into outer space and catch up with what's happening with the space program. As we reported on explorations, the Russians want to go back to the moon. It's been 50 years or so since there was the last rush to the moon. Well, their rocket was supposed to have a self-landing on the moon, but unfortunately it crashed. However, the Indians are in the game, and they've successfully had a soft landing on the moon. And you may ask yourself the question, why? Why bother? Well, there are at least two reasons why. First of all, the southern polar region of the moon has barely been analyzed by scientists. And we find evidence of ice. Now, this is extremely important because to import ice to the moon from the Earth would bankrupt the cost of the space program. Why not harvest ice as it exists naturally on the moon? And where does this ice come from? You may say to yourself that the moon is barren, that it's lit up by the heat of the sun, and therefore any water would have evaporated billions of years ago. Well, yes, but there's two things that we have to take into account. And one is comets. Comets are dirty icebergs. And when a comet smashes into the moon, a lot of the ice simply evaporates away. But some of the comets land in the southern part of the moon where there are a lot of shadows. And the temperature there is drop to the point where ice can exist as solid ice, rather than sublimating as water vapor. And sure enough, the initial data from the Indian probe seemed to indicate that, yes, there is water down there. If that's true, that means that the next lunar bases for our astronauts could be in the southern hemisphere of the moon. And why do we need ice? For several reasons. First of all, ice is made of H2O, H being hydrogen, which can be used for rocket fuel, oxygen, which can be used for breathing and also rocket fuel. And it means, therefore, that H2O can supply our astronauts with things to breathe and things to drink. That's why we want to be able to find out more about the southern polar region. And then next year, to top it off, if all goes well, we're going to send astronauts back to the moon. They're not going to land on the moon, but the Artemis spacecraft will orbit around the moon. And it means that, yes, Americans are going back into outer space after about a 50-year of absence. There's going to be a woman and a person of color, at least, in the crew of the spaceship that will take our astronauts back to the moon. Then the year after that, We're going to land on the moon, a soft landing on the moon. That's the next goal. And the goal beyond that is to see whether or not we can create a moon base. The goal of this operation is twofold. One is to create a permanent presence on the moon. This is significant. It means that we're not just going to land on the moon, come back, and say, we won, we scored a touchdown, that's it, game over. No, we're going to be there to stay. This means having a lunar orbiter in orbit around the moon, and also using all of this as a stepping stone to go to Mars. Now, a journey to Mars would be much more difficult. It only takes 3 days, a hop, skip, and a jump, to go from the Earth to the moon. To go to Mars, a one-way trip to go to Mars would take almost a year, 2 years for a round trip around the lunar surface. And so it's not going to be easy. Plus, of course, there's radiation. There's the possibility of an accident, losing oxygen in space with an accident, possibility of meteorite collisions. All sorts of nightmares can happen. But that's the human spirit, that we're going back to the moon. And it means that if we find water on the moon, that could significantly drop the cost of space exploration. It would mean that a moon base, a permanent moon base, is a definite possibility. Now, are we going to find aliens on the moon? Probably not. We see no evidence of alien activity on the moon. However, if you saw the movie 2001, in the movie 2001, they find evidence of an obelisk on the moon. And that obelisk was basically a relay station by which the aliens from their homeworld could then communicate with their creatures on the Earth. And so that fires up the imagination that maybe the moon isn't such a dead object at all, but perhaps is a stepping stone for alien life on the moon. Well, who knows, of course, that's just a movie, but it's always good to think about some of these ideas because we're going back into outer space. And the last question is, why bother? I mean, after all, it's expensive to go into outer space. It costs about $10,000 to put a pound of anything into orbit around the Earth. And that's your weight in gold. So think of your body made out of solid gold. And that's basically what it costs to put you, as a human being, into outer space. So why bother? Well, I like to quote the words of Carl Sagan, who said, well, basically, look at the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs, ladies and gentlemen, did not have a space program. And that's why they're not here today to debate the question. They got wiped out. We've been on the Earth for maybe, 200,000 years or so. That's how long we humans have been on the Earth. The dinosaurs were on the Earth 200 million years. 200 million years. And overnight, they got wiped out by a meteor or comet that hit the Yucatan of Mexico. They didn't even know what hit them, even though they had plenty of time to develop a big brain, plenty of time to begin to master some of the laws of biology and physics. Nope. They didn't evolve a large brain at all. And so in some sense, we're lucky. We're lucky in the sense that we do have a large brain. A large brain big enough to already have put probes on the moon. And perhaps the next state would be to build, modestly speaking, a moon base, and then perhaps on to Mars. You know, we humans have been able to split the atom. We've been able to send rockets to the moon and beyond. And we've been able to take photographs of the farthest reaches of the universe, including black holes. And the question is, what about the greatest mystery of all, which sits on your shoulders? That is, the brain. We've touched on the fact that something as simple as dreams have evaded our greatest scientific minds, though now we have instruments by which we can probe the nature of dreams. But what about the mind itself? So in this section of exploration, we're going to talk about the birth of the mind. How does the mind operate? What does it mean when we say something is conscious? So today we're going to talk about a brief history of the mind. And also, by the way, speaking of the mind, you may want to get a copy of my latest book. It's a bestseller, New York Times bestseller, and it's called Quantum Supremacy, about the fact that we're entering the quantum era when we will compute not just on transistors, but we'll compute on atoms, the ultimate nature of reality itself. Quantum computers, which will be in principle millions of times more powerful than ordinary computers. And some people think that our brain works on the quantum level, and our brain is in some sense a quantum computer.
And now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. He's Professor William Calvin. He's professor at the University of Washington in Seattle, and he's the author of a book called A Brief History of the Mind. He's an expert in the origins of humanity, and so we'll go back. We'll go back 6 to 7 million years when we first separated from the apes and begin the process of trying to figure out how is it that humans became humans. How is it that humans accumulated a large brain? How did we gain the capability of being able to split the atom and explore the universe? So once again, our special guest today is Professor William Calvin of the University of Washington in Seattle. And the topic of today is A Brief History of the Mind. The first question for you is, how did you, as a scientist, first get interested in science?
Well, that's interesting, because I wasn't a particularly good student in high school, and I certainly didn't get interested in science then, though I took the courses. I just didn't have very good teachers. But when I got to college, all of a sudden, I had good professors, and it was more interesting than anything else I'd ever done. I basically gave up all of my previous interests in photography and journalism and even sports. I'd been the sports editor of my school paper in high school. But I really gave all those things up because science was so interesting. And that's an answer I suspect that applies to a lot of people.
Okay, but why anthropology? Why brain studies? Why the study of primates? How'd you get steered into that direction?
Via humans, actually. That's a late interest, and it really occurred because I had a colleague in the neurosurgery department who was working on the physiology of language cortex, and because I was assisting him in some other projects, I learned quite a lot about his subject, and it led me into the question of how did the brain get reorganized, not it's not really a question of enlargement. It's a question of, the whole tip of the temporal lobe is now doing something different than it does in monkeys. And the whole question of how did that evolve in human evolution was what led me into the rest of human evolution.
Okay. Well, let's get into the meat of your book, A Brief History of the Mind. Your book is chronological, and you start going back 6, 7, 8 million years ago when certain conditions in Africa were met and we, our ancestors, separated from the apes, in particular, a chimpanzee-like creature. Could you elaborate what happened? Why did we separate to begin the long journey to become Homo sapiens?
Well, you have to start with what the apes are capable of. The chimpanzees are the ones that we know the most about. And they can exist in savanna, woodland-type settings. Most of them live in forests, but in say, Senegal, you find them in more open territory. And that's what I imagine our ancestors as being in, because a lot more woodland and savanna was beginning to develop in Africa about 7 million years ago. I mean, that's when animals like the Cape buffalo, you know, first appear on the scene. And all of the antelope in Africa that were evolving in this period. So there's a lot of grass around and a lot of meat on the hoof. And eventually our ancestors, you know, learned how to, you know, hunt reliably. But the transition to that is what's fascinated anthropologists for a long time.
Now, speaking about that, some people conjecture that it was the upright posture. That was the first glimmers of our separation from the apes. Could you elaborate?
Well, the upright posture and sort of the rearrangement of where the spinal cord comes into the head is first seen back around the 6-7 million year territory. And that's one of the best evidence for upright posture, sort of a rebalancing of the head on top of the spinal cord. that presumably is because our ancestors were getting out of the trees and out into a bipedal kind of setting. And whether that was running in our present notion of running long distances is probably not the answer. Their feet just were not rearranged until much later. But it's thought that what they were doing is they were still nesting at night in trees the way the chimpanzees do, and certainly running up a tree for protection if they got chased. But they were coming down out of it and making a living in the woodland and savanna kinds of settings. Mostly woodland, because you got to keep the trees close. But you need upright posture if you're going to scavenge and run away, you know, with you know, at least a piece of meat, and have the other animals stay there and consume the carcass rather than chase you. So upright posture for both carrying, you know, away stuff, and for also keeping your head up above the grass so you can see that you're not walking into another lion coming. Both of those things are part of the rationale for why you get upright posture.
Now, if we begin to leave the forest and move into the open grasslands and assume an upright posture, what about our thumb? Thumbs, we know, primates use thumbs for, among other things, swinging in trees. So was the thumb, therefore, maladapted for the forest, but very adapted for a new purpose in the savannas?
Well, for swinging from trees, you actually want a small thumb that will stay out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really much more a matter of hanging by the other four fingers. The kind of power grip that you associate with the thumb is not a big part of this. It is a big part of holding onto rocks and bashing them together to get a sharp edge. But I really, you know, the evidence really isn't in on the thumb yet, the way it is on upright posture.
Okay, so now we're in the grasslands. It is now, again, 6-7 million years ago.
Well,
but things begin to change. Why?
Well, first of all, you have a long period where nothing much seems to happen. That is to say, the climate is producing more and more woodland, because basically instead of having a carpet of trees in Africa, you're going to a lot of patches in between groups of trees. And woodland tends to appear around the edges of the forests as a transition. And so because everything was becoming patchy, woodland was really the growth environment. If you could make a living in woodland, there was more of it being produced every year. So that's one of the things that's going on all through this period. Actually, getting out onto savanna with its implication of a tree every mile or so is probably something that occurs around 1.8 million with Homo erectus. It's just not that clear they were in Savannah settings until then.
Okay, so what gradually led to the enlargement of the brain? The brain did not suddenly appear in full-fledged form. It grew very slowly, but why?
Well, no one knows is the short answer. Everybody assumes it has something to do with living a more complicated life and needing more brain to do it. But, you know, if you do comparative studies with other animals, things like that, you just don't find good examples the way that you'd like to. It's true that, say, the ravens amongst the birds tend to have somewhat bigger brains, but it's not a consistent sort of thing. Grazing animals have smaller brains per unit body weight than do their predators, but it's all sort of small stuff like this. It's just say a thing about a threefold enlargement in only 2.5 million years, which produces about four times more neocortex. So that's the question. That's the one I'm saying no way really has a satisfactory answer.
Well, if for people who saw the movie 2001, there's that famous scene where a chimpanzee-like creature grabs a piece of bone, lifts it up, smashes other bones, and right. Then the bone becomes a space station in outer space.
Right.
Very famous scene. Is there any scientific basis to that it was tool-making that required a larger brain because we were maladapted for life in the savannas?
Well, that, again, is a common assumption. And the problem with it is that archaeologists have been hard at work on the tool-making record the last 2.5 million years. And it's not a record of study progress. For example, you get the first tools back at about 2.7 million, and they're basically rocks with sharp edges because, you know, there's some rocks that are better for chipping away like this than others. They are somewhat economical, and they will hit a rock instead of just once to get a sharp edge. They may hit it a second time to get two before they go off and use it. But the initial tool-making styles, so-called Odoowan styles, are not sort of like a set of silverware with very distinct styles. They're just characterized by a sharp edge and a good grip. And, there's lots of shapes that will satisfy. That went on for 1 million years with no particular improvements. At the same time, the brain was enlarging quite steadily during that time.
Okay, well, there is a theory that says that in some sense, man did not make tools. Tools made man, in the sense that in order to survive, increase your evolutionary survival value in the forest, in the savannas, you had to create tools, and that forced large brains to coordinate those tools, or else you didn't survive to perpetuate your species into the next generation.
But
what are your thoughts?
What this meta-analysis that I was just quoting to you says is not a very good explanation. That is to say, yes, you may have had to get over a threshold, but why does brain size keep increasing when tool-making doesn't change its complexity for 1 million years? And does this twice in our evolutionary history. I mean, it's just a story that is not one of constant improvement.
And what is your theory? You have any speculations as to what you think caused the large brain to slowly get larger and larger over millions and millions of years?
Well, I don't have a theory that, is widely accepted. I mean, nobody's, this is all still quite an unsettled question. I'm driven to look at it as the brain size increase secondary to something else in development that just incidentally produces a larger brain. For example, if you've got a reorganized brain, particularly that temporal lobe that I mentioned before, it may be that an easy way to do that is to do the reorganization in a slightly larger brain. I mean, it's sort of like if you're going to rearrange your, all the rooms in your house or something, it's nice to have a little surge space someplace to store stuff in while you're moving. And so the reorganization just worked better in brains that were a little bit larger.
Okay.
So that within a given generation, those that had somewhat larger brains would be the ones that more easily grew up with a reorganized brain.
Okay, now...
In this view, the size isn't the main thing. It's the reorganization. And it might be that we could even downsize to chimpanzee-sized brains as long as we kept the reorganization, and we might still be as smart.
Okay, now let's talk about 100,000 and 60,000 years ago. Most textbooks say that about 100,000 years ago, plus or minus, modern humans, that is, humans that look like us, are erect, spinal cord, our structure. They say that if you give them a shave, a three-piece suit, and put them on Wall Street, they would look pretty much indistinguishable from all the other barbarians on Wall Street.
Right.
However, you take a slightly different spin on this, and you say that, well, where is the evidence that they were modern and could cite poetry and create all sorts of advanced tools? What are your thoughts about what happened now 60 to 100,000 years ago?
Well, the context, it's we're Homo sapiens, you know, our species, by about, it's now 200,000 years ago. That is to say, in Africa, you're seeing evidence of our species, you know, back around 200,000 years ago. Now, their behavior hadn't changed very much. It's very unclear what the transition, you know, was about. But in terms of any sort of study, you know, change in complexity of life, it's pretty slow going until about 100,000 years ago. And then by about 50,000, and all these are plus or minus 20,000, by about 50,000, you're starting to see widespread evidence of creativity. That is to say, they're making lots of new things. And that's certainly not the case, you know, earlier. You're beginning to get evidence of substantial long-distance trading. And, you know, trading involves doing some planning. That is to say, you're going to have a market for your goods when you get there, and you've got something desirable to bring home. The evidence for higher intellectual function having taken a substantial, you know, advance is all over, you know, the archaeological record. And that's when a lot of people assume that, that something like syntax must have come in, too, as the, it's part of higher intellectual function that enables you to not just have, you know, two words put together to make a simple sentence, but being able to make one of these long, involved sentences.
So you would put language and the ability to manipulate and join and splice together more than just one thought into one sentence as sort of the core of what caused the Big Bang roughly 60,000 years ago?
Yeah. Basically, I think that you have this... Big Bang is sort of a popular term for what John Pfeiffer called the creative explosion, which is a much more descriptive term of what it's about. You know, it's about creativity and tool making, creative planning, other things. It shows up best, of course, in the art, where you even get perspective, you know, fairly early on in cave painting. It goes back 37,000 years at least. So just within the middle of that, you know, period, 70,000 down to 35,000, there's just all sorts of evidence of something really new is happening.
Mm-hmm.
They're leading much more complex lives. You know, it has evidence in it of much more sophisticated thought processes.
Okay, now going
now whether that's driven by syntax or whether syntax is another one of those things that you get through secondary use of mental machinery for something else, you know, that's open.
Okay. Now, you also mentioned in your book Ice Ages. Ice Ages is one of the principal drivers of human evolution. Could you elaborate on that idea?
Well, it, in general, climate change is one of the things that speeds up evolution. It just provides a more unsettled environment that where new niches can develop that variants on species could fill and become a new species. So human evolution is going to be another example of that, but all you can really say is that it speeds up what you know might be there to happen otherwise. You know, personally, I think that the main thing going is not a slow, steady change in the environment, but that there were pretty rapid things going on. I mean, ice ages, you know, take 100,000 years, and that's pretty slow. I mean, nobody knows it's happening. But sprinkled in amongst all that are a lot of brief, quick changes in the environment that everybody would have noticed. I mean, for example, they would cause widespread drought and lots of fire. And after the fire comes a lot of grass growing in places where it was brush or forest before. And the grazing animals have a boom time. They start doubling and tripling their population. Take advantage of all the new grass that came after one of these drought-induced fires. So if our ancestors were hunting by that time, they were predators on grazing animals. They, again, had a big opportunity. It was a big boom time after one of these big downsizings due to drought.
Okay.
What I tend to think is that the natural selection that was operating here was not on having the right stuff to survive downsizing. You know, I think it was so quick that whether you lived or died was mostly a matter of luck rather than having the right stuff. But in the aftermath of that, where you get this big boom time in grass, I think that it would very much have mattered whether you were a good enough hunter to make a steady living off of it, and therefore could venture out of woodlands and grasslands much more permanently. But now, certainly in the sort of the 50-year aftermath, one of these abrupt cooling and drought and windy and dusty climate changes.
Okay, now also your book mentions the Neanderthal. We coexisted with the Neanderthal in Europe for thousands of years. So where does the Neanderthal fit into this?
Neanderthal is sort of a specialized European, mostly, although it spreads into Asia periodically, European species that's adapted for colder climate, though they did not live in northern Europe. That was apparently too much for them. But they were clearly hunters. But it doesn't, the way it appears is that they had a method of hunting that caused them a lot of injuries. I mean, that's say Neanderthal bones often have healed fractures. And so the thought is that they probably didn't have the most sophisticated hunting techniques that allow you to stand at a distance and throw something. They were getting up close with their spears and such and taking a lot of injuries as a result. There's not particularly good evidence for them having any sophisticated language. They probably, like our ancestors about 200,000 years ago, had simple language like two-year-olds, as say they had words. They could put them together into making short sentences, but they couldn't engage in the complicated thought that goes along with long sentences.
Now, the Neanderthals, I take it, did not have this big bang that we had that allowed right. us to create complex sentences, manipulate more than just one thought at a time, and plan and strategize, right?
Right. They clearly were capable of making more sophisticated tools. As to say, when our Homo sapiens ancestors moved into the neighborhood, the Neanderthals picked up on their techniques. And began producing, you know, similar kinds of things. So they may not have been as inventive, or if they were inventive, it kept dying out all the time. But certainly they didn't have an intellectual Big Bang. Perhaps, you know, because the climate really, you know, wiped them out. They were a European species, and Europe in that period when they died out was getting colder and colder. The glaciers were taking over more and more of their territory. And a lot of species got sort of pushed south into the Mediterranean and went extinct. And it may be that Neanderthals are another example of that.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, inviting you to join us every week for a discussion of science and its impact on society. And also, you may want to pick up a copy of my latest book. It's now a New York Times bestseller. It's called Quantum Supremacy. It's about quantum computers, about the next generation of computers beyond digital computers. You know, digital computers compute on zeros and ones, zeros and ones, zeros and ones. But that's a crude approximation to Mother Nature. Mother Nature does not use digital information. Mother Nature uses quantum information, that is, information from the atom. And that's what this book is all about. Quantum Supremacy is about the next generation of computers beyond digital computers. Because in the future, we're going to be using electron information rather than digital information in order to do our calculations. This means that perhaps we'll be able to get a handle on diseases, to get a handle on energy production, to get a handle on global warming, because all these phenomena are not digital. All these phenomena are done at the molecular level, and that's the language of Mother Nature. You see, Mother Nature does not use zeros and ones, zeros and ones. If you don't believe me, just go outside. When you go outside, you see photosynthesis at work. Mother Nature taking sunlight and converting it to sugars. And that, of course, is the foundation of life on the planet Earth, photosynthesis. But you see, photosynthesis cannot be explained using zeros and ones, zeros and ones. Photosynthesis is a quantum process, and that's what this book is about. It's about quantum computers, computers that don't calculate on zeros and ones, zeros and ones, but calculate on electron shells. That's the language of Mother Nature. The language of Mother Nature is to compute on electron shells and find out what the excitement is about. Wall Street, Apple, Google, IBM, they're all jumping on the bandwagon because they don't want to be left out when we make the transition from digital to quantum. The book is Quantum Supremacy.
Do you find yourself scanning for something different yet familiar? It's at KPFT Houston. Blues and Hi-Fi can be found at the end of our Sunday Blues Block each week. My name is Clint Broussard, and I'd love for you to join me Sundays from 5 to 7 p.m. Central Time for a deep dive into the blues and all of its shades for Gulf Coast Radio that colors outside the lines. It's Blues and Hi-Fi Sundays, 5 to 7 p.m. We also re-air Fridays from 2 to 4 p.m. on our lovely HD2 channel. You can catch us worldwide at kpft.org. It's listener-supported, commercial-free, KPFT Houston.
So
it's 90.1 KPFT. Time to check in with the R&R show.
A rascally one who exhibits the characteristics of a rascal.
See, I would know nothing about that because I've always been,
well, pretty much an angel, as many people will tell you.
Sometimes you can be a little too close to something. It's kind of a forest and trees
effect. I see.
Just throwing that out there for your consideration.
Well, I understand, but no, it's hard sometimes to get in the car when the halo gets stuck in the door. Words to live by.
Yeah. Okay. The wings, too, I'm sure.
Exactly.
Enjoy the great decades of music, fun, and banter with R&R.